to harm their economy. You're not allowed to make them unemployed and impoverished.
But everything that Israel does in the occupied territories, U.S. taxpayers are paying for. The U.S. gives the financing, it gives the military support.
Israel receives as much foreign economic assistance as all the countries combined in the world.
In March 2003, the U.S. government approved $10 billion in aid for Israel. At the same time, it withheld a $3.5 billion grant to upgrade the training of first responders, those who would be first to respond to a terrorist attack. Spent domestically, that $10 billion could buy health care coverage for over 4 million children without proper coverage, or pay for 1.5 million American children to attend Head Start child development programs to prepare them for school, or simply help states offset the costs of one of the worst fiscal crises in half a century.
That the American commitment to Israel is so strong that it's not only reflecting the impact of well-organized pro-Israeli lobbies, but it also represents the views of the Pentagon that sees Israel now as an indispensable strategic ally in the effort to control and exert influence throughout the region.
The main concern for the United States, like the world, is the oil-producing regions. And in order to control that, you need a way of doing it.
Desperate for a peace that would finally end occupation, Palestinians again came to the negotiating table in 2000.
People think, look, Israel was very forthcoming. It offered 95% of the West Bank, of the occupied territories to the Palestinians, and they rejected it in violence. The assumption of that 95% argument is that getting 95% of the land gives you 95% sovereignty, a sovereign country. But I think it's very useful to think in terms of a prison. If you look at a blueprint of a prison, it looks like the prisoners own the place. And the prisoners have 95% of the area. They've got the living areas, they have the exercise yard, they have the cafeteria, they've got the work areas. All the prison authorities have is 5%, is the control.
The average Palestinian didn't think they were throwing anything away because there was nothing to throw away. They had tuned out what Barak and Arafat were talking about, because on the ground there were ongoing land expropriations, tree uprootings, road building, unfair water allocation, leaving many Palestinian families in the summer and fall with 2 hours of running water a week, when next door you have a settlement with a swimming pool and green lawns. So what do you expect people to think?
And it was that pressure, that sense of being squeezed, that finally exploded in September of 2000 in what became the Second Intifada.
Second Intifada is essentially a mobilization of resistance against this structure of occupation and oppression. Israel, from the very beginning of these demonstrations, had indeed relied on excessive force. They had used live ammunition against unarmed demonstrators, had inflicted several deaths, and hundreds of casualties in the opening days of the Intifada.
Sometimes the Israelis are speaking about rubber bullets they used. By the way, it's not rubber, it's steel coated with rubber. This bullet, it killed many of the kids who are demonstrating, I mean, sometimes while they are throwing stones. As this case, I'll show you what happened. He is 14 years old from Khan Yunis. He was shot with one like this and entered here, and he died.
A lot of the deaths have been children, and we do have some documentary evidence that security forces are firing on crowds of children.
The soldiers weren't at risk. They're heavily armored, they have all this high-powered weaponry, and no child with a stone is going to be a risk to them.
Most of the Palestinian abuses involve shooting at settlements, ambushes on settler cars, and obviously the suicide bombings inside Israel.
There are some risks to Israeli life.